Welcome to the IPv6 Buzz podcast, where we dare to dive into the 128-bit address space wormhole. I'm Ed Horley with my co-host Tom Coffeen. Scott Hoag is out this for this one, teaching a class. But we wanted to let everyone know in the audience, hey, we have sponsorships available for the podcast. So if you have a great IPv6 support in your product, then we want to hear all about it. So come along and sponsor the show. If you're interested in doing that, you can go to packetpushers.net/sponsorship and all the details are there. You can go ahead and fill everything out and hopefully we can hear about how you're rocking V6. But with that, today we're going to be talking about carrier grade NAT, which is not normally a topic that we would ever say we want to talk about on IPv6 Buzz, but hey, we're going to do that. And our guest is Kevin Myers and Nick Russo. And if you follow either one of them on Twitter, they have quite a bit of a conversation going back and forth. And Kevin and Nick have both done a great amount of work on V6. So welcome to both of you.
Cool. Thanks, Ed. Glad to be here.
Yeah, me too. My pleasure.
Yeah. Awesome. And just so everyone knows, Nick is actually in the process of building an IPv6 course for Pluralsight. I have V6 courses up there, but you definitely want to take Nick's when that stuff releases, because he's going to be doing all sorts of cool stuff. And as part of that, he actually threw out on Twitter some discussions about, hey, what should make it in the course or not make it in the course, and what's going to be good about V6 or not. And then Kevin stuck his nose in, talking about carrier grade NAT, and should that be a technology that folks actually learn around V6. And so we wanted to have an opportunity to sort of bring that into the podcast and talk about it and see, you know, what everyone's thoughts were. So maybe, I don't know, should we start with Kevin or should we start with Nick, or what's first here?
I think we should start with Kevin, because I think his experience with CGN is more conventional, in that he deploys it in service provider networks as a IPv6 transition technique, whereas my experience with it is a little more niche, where I've used it in military style networks. And that might be a little bit harder for learners to relate to. So I think with Kevin's more conventional experience and SP, I think that's probably the better place to start for the listeners.
Yeah, sure. You can throw me under the bus. I'll go first. So one of the things that I looked at when we started the conversation is, first of all, Nick's focus was around the enterprise. So I stuck my nose in, like Ed said, because I'm coming more from a service provider view. But when you look at what I do today in my consulting company, I work as a consultant with a team that works all over the world, working for mostly service providers, but we do some enterprise and data center work too. We use carrier grade NAT a lot. One of the main reasons is because it's cost effective to enable IPv6 at scale. And a lot of people kind of, think that's odd, because carrier grade NAT doesn't really technically touch IPv6. But one of the things that Nick and I got into when we were talking about it on Twitter is that when you look at the largest connected community of users of IPv6 that's out there, it's going to be your mobile devices that are on LTE that we're now moving to 5G. I mean, there's, I think, hundreds of millions of them or billions of them. And they built them as, once we got into LTE and we moved away from 3G, they built it as dual stack day one, because they recognized the scale at which we were building required that we needed the scale of IPv6, and we needed that out there. But they also needed IPv4 connectivity, because when we started doing this 10 years ago in the carrier world, we were nowhere near as far along in application development and compatibility in IPv6 as we are now. So that's what we started with. And the ecosystems of carriers developed around that. And I think one of the points that I made was in the RAN, in the carrier world, which, if you're not familiar with it, that's the radio access network. So every cell tower that exists in every town that you've ever been in and connected to connects back to some kind of a regional aggregation network through an incredibly complex series of systems to get back to an IP MPLS network and reach the internet. That's how you get there. You get you're going to get an IP address that's probably going to be in the 100.64 range, which is used for carrier grade NAT, and you're going to get an IPv6 global unicast address, and that's what's going to go to your phone. And using DNS, you're going to go find, if you're going to go to Google or Facebook or one of the other applications on the internet that's IPv6 connected, DNS is going to steer you there. And if not, it's going to take you the V4 route. And that's the way we've operated in the carrier world. And to some degree, that's really still how we build, because it's the most proven and the most effective. So it allows us to get V6 into the hands of people that probably otherwise wouldn't use it. And I think one of the most important things is, if we just put IPv6 out there, as we put out a dual stack topology and we put carrier grade NAT in to make the transition easier, and we just had it available for them to use, they wouldn't use it. It's the fact that it's a managed endpoint and we pushed it that causes people to use it. And the same is true in the wireline world. in the wireline world, where providers tend to manage the routers, I mean, you can plug your own router, you know, wireless access point in behind a carrier handoff, but most of the carriers manage that because they can push V6 because they know that 99% of the people out there, except for maybe gamers or, you know, IT people, are going to go mess with V6. So that's the way in which the carriers were able to push it out in an ubiquitous way. And most importantly, one of the things that I really like about it is it tends to be the most cost-effective. The systems for CGNAT are well-validated. They're there. You can use them at scale. And you can just continue to push the traffic footprint towards V6 when you have it out there as more and more systems are connected. So that's one of the things I like about it, is it provides you that end-to-end connectivity without manipulation of the packet in flight. So, I mean, that's kind of where I'm coming from when I look at carrier-grade NAT and how we deploy it for the ISPs that I work with.
Yeah, so I guess a question for you, Kevin, and this is just from my... you know, from a few of the applications, or I should say the business problems that I've solved with CGN in some tactical customers, is when we tried to use it, it was in less of a, you know, let's provide access to mobile and wireline clients, like in your case, where I think in a lot of those cases, like you said, gamers, there's going to be some people that are, you know, trying to do peer-to-peer stuff that may not work too well across CGN. But in your case, or at least for a lot of consumers, they need web access. They need, you know, kind of a very north-south flow to the internet to access applications and such, a lot of HTTP. Have you ever seen cases where there have been maybe lots of customers or specific businesses where something like an application level gateway or ALG support was difficult to implement for CGNAT? I'm just curious if you've run into issues like that, because you mentioned that the packets don't change in flight, and I think that's generally true. But of course, when you have IP addresses embedded in payloads, ALGs start to matter, like FTP and SIP and some of these other protocols that can maybe be a little tricky. And I know, of course, carriers have ways around that, but I'm just wondering if you've ever run into any roadblocks with ALGs.
Yeah, they do. I should probably revise my statement in that we try to minimize the manipulation of the packet rather than no manipulation, because with V6 native, the goal is there's always been end-to-end connectivity without manipulating the packet as much as you possibly can by, right, you know, changing headers, changing options, whatever that is. And you're absolutely right. In the early days of carrier grade NAT, if you go back, you know, if I go back to my very first world IPv6 day, I was working at an ILEC in a telco, and I still had to tunnel to Hurricane Electric because our transit upstreams didn't have IPv6 connectivity. They weren't ready. That was, I think, 2011, maybe. And so, you know, when we first did that, there were a lot of things that did not work, especially like you talk about ALG when you're doing an application level gateway, whether it's with SIP, whether it's with another real-time protocol. There were a lot of problems around those in the early days, and it took a long time to kind of tune that. If you go and look at the way it's done now, one of the things they are really good about in V4, and this is an area that I think if you're going to go into a V6 translation mechanism that still needs a bit of maturity, is over the last decade, they've really understood what things tend to get really unhappy. Xbox is a great example. The people at Xbox go through unbelievable hurdles to detect the type of NAT being used and then tell the gamers when they think the NAT that the carrier is using is not right. And they will actually get like a pop-up on the gaming station saying this type of NAT is being used and it's causing you a problem. And so what the carrier-grade NAT systems that are deployed have done is they have application module plugins that will actually look for those types of traffic that tend to be more problematic, like SIP, real-time protocols, you know, things that that may really trip up a traditional NAT system, and they will just deal with that protocol. Like if it's an upper layer protocol that needs to be, you know, rewritten or modified, they're pretty good at recognizing that, and then they'll modify that. Now, this is in the V4 world, and this is something that as I haven't gotten into a lot of the V6 translation technologies, except to start to play around with 464xlat. Like we're actually starting to play around with that for a customer. I'm not super deep in that yet. But one of the things in talking around the carrier world is that we have about 10 years of maturity in understanding where those challenges are and things that break when they go through NAT. And we're still working through that in the V6 world when we start talking about manipulating V4 into V6 in both ways.
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, I think one of my observations has been that you get that level of expertise because you're doing it every single day, right? So they had to solve the problems, so they're going to build that maturity naturally for what's happening there. I think V6 gets around a bunch of those related issues sort of from the end-to-end connectivity standpoint, so they haven't concentrated on it as much. It's probably what my gut feeling is
is sort of at with anything that's happening there. There are a couple of other methods that are available. And we had a show with Andrew Yurchenko talking about MAPI and MAPT. And I don't know if folks are familiar with that, and you can go listen to that show that's more in depth to sort of talk about it, but it is another transition mechanism to really sort of make things a little bit better in terms of those mapped ports and having, you know, sort of the right sort of state be able to give for the total number of session flows that are happening. And then
I guess we should be really clear about what we're talking about when we're talking about CGN, because like for me, when I hear MAPT and MAPE, I think that's CGN, right? I mean, so for the listeners that aren't familiar with maybe what constitutes CGN, you know, 464 XLAT is a translation technology that gets used, you know, but at some point defining what CGN is and then getting to the point where we sort of review the objections that, you know, that Kevin's pointing out after 10 years of heavy duty deployment, maybe they're not valid anymore. But what do we mean by CGN? Like what specifically are the transition technologies or the translations that we're talking about?
Well, I can speak from the carrier side to say that there, you know, there's really, when you get into a CGNAT engine, there's, and you're going to talk about just translating V4 to V4, there's usually two mechanisms. It's what they'll call NAT44 or NAT444, which essentially just means, am I going to take one non-publicly routable address and NAT it to a public and use one layer of NAT? And that's NAT44, which is mostly what, you know, we do in a lot of enterprise networking where, you know, we're doing port address translation and it was a firewall or something like that. Very basic. Everybody, we call it NATing, we call it, you know, whatever. What most people will refer to when they talk about CGNAT is what we in the carrier world is often called NAT444, which means you're going to have a pool of public IPv4 addresses that's, you know, with a regional internet registry where you get them that you advertise in your transits. They're publicly routable in a pool. They sit at a CGNAT gateway that is in the data plane, that is a, you know, is a throughput point in a data center, a CO somewhere. And then that is going to route to an address in the 100.64.0.0/10 range, which is a running private joke between Nick and I, because I love that range and he always dings me for it because I use it in places that you shouldn't, but so does Google, so I make no apologies. And so you have that layer. You have a 100.64 address that is going to go out to the customer and the subscriber, and it normally via DHCP will land on their gateway of whatever kind the carrier puts out. And then you're going to have an RFC 1918 network behind that. So you kind of have a two-stage NAT happening there. And that's what most people mean by carrier grade NAT or large scale NAT, as it used to be called. I don't hear people call it that much as more. That was real popular 10 years ago. Most people call it carrier grade NAT. But there's another thing that isn't often talked about as much that is very unique to the carrier world, and that's compliance. Because one of the things that the carriers have to do when they, and they realized this was a challenge a decade ago, is that you have to be able to match the IP, the public IP that's being used, back to a subscriber at any given point in time. Because if you do something naughty on the internet and the FBI knocks on your door, you've got to be able to provide that relationship of tracking. And in the United States, I can't speak for other countries because I don't do it as much as far as the regulatory side, but there is it's not really an organization, but it's something the FBI puts out. It's called CALEA, Carrier Assistance to Law Enforcement Organizations. So if you do something you're not supposed to on your service provider and the FBI becomes aware of it or local law enforcement, they will issue a subpoena to the carrier. And the carrier has got to basically produce, yeah, this is the address, this is the subscriber, and they were connected to this site, this IP endpoint at this point in time. And when NAT's involved, that can be very, very challenging. So one of the things we do in a carrier-grade NAT gateway is we will actually, the device will do this. We will actually build dynamic source port ranges for that customer. And so the logging and analytics in the software knows that any traffic that came from this source port range is part of this customer going to this endpoint, and then that gets logged. And that's a very distinctly different action than what you normally see when you're NATing an address through a typical enterprise firewall. And that is one of the things that very distinctly makes it carrier-grade NAT, because you're very clearly trying to track the relationship between all three of those IPs.
Carrier-grade spying.
Yep, exactly. That's exactly it. Whole new podcast.
So, and that was always the objection, like back in the day. It was like, well, there are three, right? I mean, if you go to a V6 conference in circa 2011, the time frame you're talking about, it was always like carrier grade NAT. Okay, what are the three problems? The TCP port exhaustion was one, you know, breaks geolocation, defeats geofencing sort of techniques, and then breaks lawful intercept. So, I mean, based on what you're saying, it sounds like maybe the lawful intercept piece has been solved.
Kind of, yeah. I mean, I think Kevin's explanation was excellent, by the way. As he was saying it, I was thinking the same thing in my head. So that was for the listeners out there not familiar, very good explanation by Kevin. But in terms of lawful intercept, just to be a little bit of a nitpick here, when I think lawful intercept, I think like actually providing access for law enforcement to look at devices through SNMP or some other mechanism to look at traffic, or maybe, you know, basically the equivalent of a span port built into devices for LE. The high-speed logging or HSL or whatever you want to call it, basically tracking the bindings between subscribers and their port and at different times, because of, like Kevin said, these things change over time. A good approach, again, like Kevin said, is to give individual subscribers port ranges so that the logging doesn't have to be quite as extreme. This is more of a, you know, out of band, there's been a subpoena issued or some other court document that says you have to do XYZ, and then they can provide that information, again, typically out of band in some kind of report. Another thing that I think is worth mentioning here, and Kevin, maybe you can speak to what this looks like from a CapEx and an OpEx perspective, is just maintaining the logging retention infrastructure for all of those bindings. Because again, you know, we call it carrier grade because it's huge. I mean, these are giant hardware devices typically that are aggregating potentially thousands of users in the aggregation network. We have the 1064 range. Then we have all the CPEs with all their 192, 168s that do the first layer of NAT. So these devices are, of course, going to have tons of NAT entries that are constantly changing, and all that information needs to be digitally retained to provide in response to law enforcement requests. So, Kevin, I'm curious what kind of things you've seen, because, again, this is an area that I haven't worked a whole lot, and I'm curious to know how that plays into the financial investment justifications that these carriers have to go through, because, you know, buying the CGN router is one cost, but then the operational cost of maintaining all that logging. I'm wondering if you've seen that be a big, you know, is that like a drop in the bucket for carriers, or is that like a big deal that requires a lot of planning in your experience?
You know, so really that's an excellent point. I'll back up and say a couple of things. So CALEA is the legal framework under which they are authorized legally, state and local law enforcement entities and the federal law enforcement entities, to approach a carrier with a subpoena and make a request of anything that's covered under that framework. And then you made a good point to disambiguate lawful intercept versus a subpoena to track an IP for, like, as far as the evidence chain that they want to verify this action was performed by this person and verify that, like, all of those fall under CALEA. So, like, lawful intercept and the verification of the IP, there are all these different things that you have to track and you're required to report on that fall under the CALEA framework. And you're right, lawful intercept, where you're getting in, you plug the black box from the FBI into the network, and you don't really know what they're doing, but they, you know, you do a span and they capture what they capture, and you don't ever know what it is, and then they leave. But so that's lawful intercept, and that definitely happens. So there's that. But then going into the cost structure of it, one of the things, I mean, for the logging, like, it's really not too bad, because we in the carrier world, we're pushing compute more out to the edge, more so than ever before. CDN is actually a huge driver of that, because we're trying to get content as close to the customers as possible. So most carriers have already done massive investments in compute storage to not try to, like, you know, we always go through this centralization and decentralization, like, bell curve in technology. We're going to all put it in one place, and then we're going to decentralize it. And so the way the carriers are working towards right now, which is something that AT&T kind of led with their CORD project, which is central office re-architected as a data center, which basically took the view that rather than always put a piece of hardware out at the edge to a customer in a CO that's right next to you, let's just build it like a data center, using the same kind of web scale principles that Google would. And we're going to go put compute and storage and Kubernetes and orchestration, all the things you would do in a data center. So a lot of the central offices and facilities for carriers now have large amounts of storage and compute that you can dump this off to. And you don't necessarily have to centralize all of it into this massive repository like you used to. So moving that footprint out helps to defray the cost, and even smaller carriers are doing that now. And because they have to do it by law, it's not too much of an issue financially.
Come on, Kevin, you're telling me that all the carriers are now deploying Kafka to
They're not doing what?
They're deploying Kafka to ingest all the log files.
Yeah, no, we actually use Logstash. Logstash is a really common one in there. Yeah. I know it's used in the enterprise world, but we use Logstash to dedupe a lot of that and lower the footprint. Yeah.
Should we just pause for a moment and mention the irony of talking about Kafka and in relation to Lawful Intercept and Kalia?
Yeah, that's
the metamorphosis of the packet.
But it's good, and I'm glad we got some of that sort of clarified there. But I'm going to push on both of you back. How does this relate to V6? Where is the carry grade NAT components versus V6? Where is this coming in terms of the trade imbalance on going back and forth there? Because the original discussion was, and I think Kevin, you put out there, hey, you should be talking about CGNAT because it's part of the IPv6 adoption technology roadmap that folks are going to go through. And I think Nick's original point was sort of like, hey, well, if I'm teaching V6 to folks, is that really something that should be on the palette to sort of paint the picture about what's going on with V6? And I don't know where we're at on that.
Yeah. So how about this? So I'll just offer a counterpoint and maybe, you know, we can talk just a little bit about it here just for the sake of the listeners. So I would argue that CGN as a technology, it obviously has a lot of uses. And we've just heard Kevin talk for 15 minutes about all the things that he's seen it used for and why it's valuable and how there are obvious business benefits, especially to service providers who do it. And, you know, I have my own set of stories in tactical networking where I've seen it used as well to provide mobility to response forces in the U.S. Army. I can't get too much into that, but I'm well aware of the advantages to a whole diversity of organizations. But as it relates to IPv6, I'll probably stay on the position that I think CGN has slowed the adoption of IPv6 in that we have been given a tool, basically a collection of tools. We have IPv4 and we have NAT, and we can just use more of both and use that combination, that concoction, to delay the deployment of IPv6. And I think there's a few, of course, you know, we talked about earlier with, you know, issues with lawful intercept, geolocation, and Kevin has talked about how we've managed to overcome some of those challenges, how we've overcome some of the cost drivers. But I think one of the big disadvantages is that there are a lot of other new things about IPv6 that people may be taking for granted. So just as, you know, we talked about, one of the things we wanted to discuss today is what are some of the key IPv6 topics that are useful that just don't exist in the IPv4 world. So just to enumerate a few that I personally think are really important that are somewhat overshadowed or cast aside in the world of CGN. In my opinion, one of the coolest things in IPv6 is this concept of Slack and stateless DHCPv6. So just to put it into perspective, you know, if you're good with IPv4, you understand things like DNS and domain names, you understand DHCP for IPv4 and how a client can go through the discover process and all that. It can get an IP address, a mask, a default gateway, DNS servers, NTP servers, vendor options, domain names. You get all kinds of cool stuff from DHCP. We get all that in IPv6. And yes, we can do it statefully just like before, but one of the coolest things, in my opinion, is that in IPv6, we can, of course, have prefixes assigned to interfaces. Those prefixes can be signaled to clients, like to laptops or whatever, inside of router advertisement messages, you know, an ICMP v6 message type. And clients can then statelessly use that information to come up with their unique IPv6 address, either based on some kind of cryptographic algorithm, like Windows has some security settings that can give it kind of a pseudo random address. We can use MAC addresses, which are generally unique, to seed it using EUI64. So we have a lot of approaches to statelessly, which is obviously scalable, provide addressing to a whole lot of devices. And to me, that's an extremely high scale approach with very little state. This begs the question, though, how do those clients learn about DNS? How do they learn domain names? Because a client with only an address can only do so much. So what I think was, this is, again, one of the genius of IPv6, in my opinion. And, you know, they could probably do something like this for IPv4 if they wanted to. I'm just not sure that it exists. Is clients can ask for DHCP non-address information once they have an address that they've computed statelessly. And we can signal that in a router advertisement using the other config flag or the oath flag. Clients can then say, okay, I've got this RA, I've got a prefix, I compute my address. Oh, the O flag is set. So let me send an information request to the DHCP v6 server so I can collect everything other than an address. And that's a stateless process too, because the server doesn't need to track which clients are asking it for the DNS servers. That's just the same answer for every client. So what I really like about this approach is it allows us to deploy, suppose in an enterprise, especially potentially thousands of clients who are getting all their addresses statelessly because we don't necessarily need to track them anymore. This can happen in a very distributed way. And clients can also get their non-address information from DHCPv6. So in the enterprise, I see that as particularly useful. And just to extend that idea just a tiny bit in the service provider world, and Kevin, I'm sure you've seen this before, is using prefix delegation. So rather than just handing out addresses like we do with DHCP for IPv4, DHCPv6 can also hand out entire prefixes. And CPEs, especially in the carrier world, can consume that prefix, apply it or carve it up and put it on their LAN-facing interfaces, and then the process starts again. Clients can do stateless autoconfig, they can do DHCP stateless v6, and that CPE can become a stateless DHCP v6 server, providing that other configuration information to all the hosts in that CPE environment without needing to transit the aggregation and access networks back to whatever regional POP there is in the carrier network. So I know that was a lot of words to basically say that stateless autoconfig and stateless DHCP v6 generally don't exist in IPv4, and I find them to be extremely powerful tools. So I don't know if anyone else has deployed them and has some comments there.
Yeah, that's a lot right there to unpack. and a great job describing all of it, by the way, Nick. That's awesome. I have a couple quick things on that because I think they're important for folks to sort of cover or uncover. Is that it's the uniqueness value on V6? I definitely agree with. I almost see the, you know, to Kevin's point, I almost see them as sort of complementary. I do agree with you, Nick, that carrier grade NAT has I think pushed or allowed maybe mid tier players and below in the service provider space to extend their lifetime about what they can do with V4 and maybe push out what their investment on V6 is. And maybe rightfully so, to allow them more time to be able to adopt V6 in a better way. So maybe that's a counterpoint argument around some of that. And then secondarily, I feel like V6 as a net new and prefix delegation is a good example. Some other things, we're still working out some wrinkles, and to be fully transparent. And if you're in Germany and listening right now, we feel your pain on the prefix delegation side. because there's all sorts of interesting behaviors that some of the service providers have done that I don't think are to the advantage of the residential customers who are necessarily getting prefix delegations that expire and then disappear, and then they don't get assigned the same ones again. And so they have to renumber their network internally, right? So there's all sorts of structural problems with that that I think are just, will get ironed out over time. But I don't know, Tom, I think we've gotten some feedback around that.
Both. Well, and there's other issues too related to, the auto-addressing function. I mean, I totally agree with Nick that there's just so much potential benefit and configuration ease and, of course, application support down the road. I mean, this is stuff that's really not here today, but like look at the IETF draft proposing a /64 be assigned to every host as an example. Mm-hmm. I mean, other than the additional consumption of IPv6 addresses at that level, you know, the idea that you have to have some mechanisms in place to support that sort of thing. And then, that was always sort of one of the ideas around IPv6, that it would support home net environments with lots of different networks and that you could rely on something like prefix delegation to enable that. And I would think that carriers are, far enough down the path based on their operational practices where they could easily retrofit and support some of that technology. What you're describing in Germany as a counterpoint to that, that's just mere configuration, as I would call it. I guess the larger issue, though, I mean, and I think you said something earlier, Ed, just a moment ago that really resonated with me when you said it, and I think there's sort of we're approaching it in this sort of Manichaean way of, CGN or not CGN, but the reality is that it's not no but more like yes and for a lot of service providers, for a lot of carriers. It's like they're moving in the direction of IPv6. It's not as if they're deploying CGN without deploying any IPv6 at all, or they're planning on just holding out to the bitter end. Really more it's a tool to solve scale problems in different parts of the network to keep the margins, which are already razor thin, keep them large enough to make money. as a service provider, and then, you know that over time they're moving in a direction where operationally V6 will be something that's, you know, that they can move towards, like a V6 only posture or dual stack initially, obviously, and V6 only when we get to that point much yeah. later down the road. So I guess that, you know, if certain problems have been definitively solved, and we've talked through the law enforcement issue, we've talked through, we mentioned geolocation, although I don't know, has that been solved? Are we able to enforce geofencing and licensing, you know, for content? Does CGN break that for carriers?
Definitely does not help. In fact, that's one of the things that I've got an ISP client in the Midwest that we specifically deployed IPv6 because our real-time streaming services were so much better with geolocation, because we could get very, very granular, and you didn't have, like, you know, you buy a block at auction because, you know, V4 is so hard to get now. You buy a block at auction and then Netflix is not going to serve it to you because they're like, oh, you can't get this football game because this block was in Los Angeles, even though you're in Minneapolis. And so you sit there and fight that battle for 6 months with no Netflix on that one prefix block. So as it relates to that, is definitely a challenge for carrier grade NAT. That has always been one of the challenges that does make it harder. And to respond, there's so many different points I want to respond to. I have to think through, because Nick made great points. In response to prefix delegation, I'll tackle that first, and I'll backtrack in just a few minutes to how I think carrier grade NAT enables IPv6 rather than hinders it. But that's how I build the carriers that I design. In fact, what you guys described about prefix delegation with Slack at the endpoint in the home, that's how I build most of the networks that I consult for with ISPs. We actually just did one with, we did CGNAT using, it was A10, I think. We did the CGNAT gateways to deploy the IPv4 side. And then we did /56s to the customers, a prefix delegation with a /44 in major aggregation points in the network that we were allocating those 56s out of. And then we used, I think we had Juniper gear in there that was acting as the delegating router for prefix delegation to a centralized DHCP server. And that actually took a little bit of work to get the dynamic static route injection working. That was one of the things when we first worked through that, like actually getting that all to work end to end with the Linux DHCP server and like making that all work and then tying it into the billing system, which is, I don't want to go down a rabbit hole, but one of the biggest challenges carriers have as we're deploying this and pushing out V6, it's not really the network that's so hard, it's the support systems. Because in billing, like, you know, a lot of these billing systems got built forever ago, and so they've got to do these bolt-on retrofits to like get it to figure out V6. And the DUID in IPv6 is not always consistent. So one of the big challenges we're having in the carrier world is different vendors present different DUID formats. So we're trying to figure out how to make sure that billing systems can key on the right information coming in from subscriber to bind them into the support systems that automate the ISP. That's one of the single biggest challenges that we have in smaller ISPs. Larger ISPs have pretty much figured this out. All your tier ones, you know, the large retail ISPs have mostly figured this out. But smaller carriers, it's definitely a challenge in getting those pieces glued together. But the thing that I like about pairing CGNAT with IPv6 and where I feel that it really furthers IPv6 and doesn't hinder it is I look at this, and in owning a business, I tend to look at things as a businessman and as an entrepreneur a lot, and it's barrier to entry. A lot of the technologies, a lot of the more expensive technologies that you get into and things that require specialized appliances, which technically CGNAT is, but it's been around for 10 years. There's a lot of solutions out there. It's a lot more economical to deploy than it has been 10 years ago. And so you can put a native IPv6 network out with V4 and CGNAT, and you can just deploy, and it works. And it works really, really well because the application providers for all the web scale applications, Facebook, Google, YouTube, all those guys, they've done a lot better job in the last few years of making sure that if there is some problem reaching it via V6, you know, I'm sure you guys have talked about happy eyeballs on the program before, but you're going to go the V4 route. If it doesn't work via V6, you're going to go via V4, and it doesn't really stall out the way it used to. That was our biggest problem, is there were some applications that by all rights should be reachable on V6, but like it didn't work for some reason. There was some minor detail, and then it would just hang and the application would break. And then you had to disable IPv6 to make it work. And we've really come a long way there. So deploying these in parallel from a business standpoint is the lowest barrier to entry, because once V4 goes away, you just turn it off. And if you think about where we've been in our, if you think about where we've been in technology migration, like over the years, think about analog to digital TV. We broadcasted in analog signals for 50 years. And then digital TV came in and we ran them in parallel for 20 years. And then one day we just shut it off. And I see us on a similar track with IPv6. Same with ATM. In my earlier carrier days, we ran ATM and we ran Ethernet. Ethernet was really expensive. It wasn't well proven. It didn't work very well in the beginning. And now it's king. And now we rarely use ATM, but it's still there. And that's how I see IPv4 and IPv6. And it's not that I would love to see IPv6 only networks. I've built some IPv6 only networks, but the business reality is that if you get IPv6 in more places, even if you have to extend V4 to get it out there, I feel like you're getting the global IPv6 community further to that tipping point where it becomes the norm than if you're strictly pushing for V6 only networks.
Okay. So Kevin, I think I understand that. So you're saying, and you mentioned this a few minutes ago, is that even when you're doing basically greenfield deployments, you're still opting for an IPv6 plus CGN network, basically doing a dual stack in the interest of implementing happy eyeballs. Is that a good summary?
It is, because we find it to be the lowest operational cost that, unless you are a tier one and you have a really good development team to go work out the kinks of things like 464 XLAT or working on a V6 only network, and then you're going to go through some kind of packet manipulation to get your V4 traffic where it needs to be. You've got to have a really good team of people if you're going to do that. And that tends to only be able to be afforded by the larger carriers.
Right. So basically by doing the dual stack, again, I'm trying to put your argument into my mouth so that I can properly represent it. So you tell me if I'm getting it wrong here, but by deploying both at the same time, not only are you providing better service to customers, but you're also reducing your own company operational risk for the carriers. And you're also promoting IPv6, because if IPv6 is not working or there's a problem and the kinks haven't been worked out, customers can still use IPv4 while you solve the IPv6 problems instead of a big bang approach where you show up with this new thing and it falls on its face and no one wants it.
Well, that's exactly it. And we have known, if you compare and contrast enterprise and service provider, you did a really good job of summarizing that. The suite of applications that are in your worldview when you work in enterprise, because I tend to work more in service provider, but I have worked in a large enterprise and we do some enterprise consulting. So I at least think can frame up the enterprise conversation. There is a very defined scope of applications that are in your worldview of your internal applications, as well as things in public cloud and applications that you consume. And that's the suite of applications that you care about. When you expand that to the larger internet, it's just whatever you can get to. The statistical likelihood that things are just going to break and go wrong and not get supported goes way, way up when you get outside of a more narrow suite of applications. So V4, I mean, that's the reason every mobile network is, if you look, I don't know of any major provider anywhere in the world other than there's a few in Japan and like Australia that I think are working on 464 XLAT, but almost every major carrier for their mobile networks is all CGNAT and dual stack. And for that reason, it is most operationally efficient and cost effective when you factor in support costs of things that break.
Yeah, the biggest of the big, I mean, T-Mobile's doing V6 only with 464 XLAT. And Reliance Jio in India, but they obviously have the resources and budget to be able to afford doing
right
much of the things that they're doing there. So yeah,
and I think that is the future. I like 464 XLAT. I've not deployed it personally. I'm working on a deployment for somebody and kind of getting my feet wet on it. So I really like the idea of 464 XLAT, but it's definitely new to me.
Yeah.
We didn't talk about TCP port exhaustion. Has that problem been solved?
It has. There is basically using a method of TCP proxying, and translation, which is somewhat similar to the way, if you ever use WAN optimizers, they can kind of do the same thing. There's essentially a state tracking mechanism inside the gateway that can actually stack ports inside of ports. And I'm probably not the best guy to explain it because I have never really dove into the mechanics of it. I just know that we did hit that issue and there was something we had to flip on in the CGNAT gateway that it literally does almost, I can't remember if it translates the port or if it's proxying, but if you dig into the guts of it, they've solved that problem through some secret sauce that they've got in the box.
Yeah, very cool.
Well, I mean, where does this put us? Because I think my viewpoint, at least from the enterprise architecture discussion side, is that it's probably unlikely that I'm going to necessarily need to use CGNAT for anything that I'm going to run across my backbone. And I don't know, Kevin, if you necessarily agree with that, but I'm probably going to look at some sort of native dual stack, unless I look like a service provider at a large enough organization, maybe a Fortune 1000 or something, where I basically run like a service provider, but you know, all my branch sites are quote unquote customers. That could be a possibility there. But I'm probably already running a pretty robust IPv4 network as it is, and probably within an RFC space that I already own and can maintain. So I don't know. Is it something that should make it into next class and something that should be preaching?
I think enterprises have so many verticals and so many different markets that they serve. I think there are going to always be a suite of verticals in the enterprise that are, it's not going to be relevant in their scope. And I think if you look at the traditional Fortune 500, I think there's, you know, Nick's class is probably, you know, I don't want to speak for Nick, I'll let him speak for himself, but I'm sure it's targeted towards what we would consider traditional enterprise, the most common problems that you solve in enterprise. But if you look at enterprises as a whole and you get into things like energy and industrial and manufacturing, I've definitely deployed CGNAT for enterprises that are that are doing very specialized things in specific verticals where it has solved a problem. I think I mentioned the energy sector. You know, we did this. We had like 800,000 power meters that needed IP connectivity, and they were all various software versions. And some of them could be IPv4 only. Some of them could be they could do IPv6, but they had to have a V4 address assigned as well. Like, they could not function as V4 only because part of the SCADA connectivity had to be IPv4. But some of the internet connectivity could be V6. So, you know, you get into some of these weird software deployments, and when you deal with the Internet of Things, that requires that you really kind of have both. So CGNAT became a perfect solution there because that allowed them to take an ecosystem of 800,000 things that they had to buy and would have had to rebuy, which is, you know, which is hundreds of millions in capital that you would have to deal with. Whereas if I deploy that solution to solve that problem, they can organically migrate the system over to native V6 as the software and meters support it, and go through a gradual migration and still have the benefits of having that connectivity.
Like Kevin said, the diversity and the breadth of verticals within enterprise is really wide. And I'll just talk briefly about the one case where CGN was used in a military network that I helped design. So long story short is we had these flyaway kits. Each kit had its own set of addressing, kind of like imagine a CPE in a carrier environment. Every individual kit had its own small LAN with some users, and they connected over an enormous globally sized satellite communications network. And one of the devices in that kit was a government proprietary device that performed the first NAT44, to use Kevin's term, which is a good way to think about it. So it did the first translation from a 192.168 to like a 10 dot something. So it didn't use Kevin's favorite range, but it, you know, it doesn't really matter. It went from a 192 to a 10. And then at the aggregation points, which were the ground stations that connected into the internet, again, you know, the equivalent of getting your RIR addressing at your regional POPs, that's where the second layer of NAT happened. And then all those devices had direct internet access. Now, in our environment, what we did is we just used IPsec tunnels to connect those nodes back to our enterprise headquarters, because it was more of a WAN extension than an internet access design. That's a little bit irrelevant here, but we still had CGN in the network. It was just deployed in a different way. In this particular case, it was used not so much scaling by numbers, but scaling by size, because we had a relatively small number of aircraft, but they needed to go anywhere in the world. And with all the changes in addressing and the fact that this solution could be scaled up immediately if there were a large-scale global conflict, we needed to have an infrastructure to support that. So this is, again, you know, I personally consider military networks to be under the scope of enterprise for the most part. I realize that sometimes these labels are a bit limiting and inaccurate, but I think this is an example of where we used CGN as an underlay for a typical IPsec WAN design. So it's a little bit of an odd use case, but there are cases where I think it can be valuable, and that was one where it was particularly useful for us, and we deployed it relatively recently, I think about 3 years ago.
So maybe my question to you then, Nick, is why not V6 for that one then?
Yeah, the challenge here is that underlay network and that SATCOM provider was not government-owned. So there were some vendors in the mix, and if you've ever done government contracting, it can be very, yeah, you know where this is going. It can be pretty cutthroat, it can be pretty Byzantine. So we didn't have complete control over that. The good news is that the overlay was dual-stacked, of course, but the underlay was V4 only with CGN. I think V6 would have been a more natural choice there, and it probably would have worked better. If you've ever tried to do Cisco DMVPN over CGN, there are some very specific limitations that make that a little more challenging than we would have liked. I think V6 would have been, this is, you know, I used to work with a woman who was a military officer, and she used to say, this is the best technical solution, but it's not always the best tactical solution. And I think that was probably true in that case as well.
Yeah, fair enough. Well, I mean, do we have any sort of thoughts of how we want to wrap this up in terms of thinking about it? Because I think you both have completely valid points in terms of where this approach is. And I think, you know, Kevin's is very much maybe coming from one angle of very pragmatic and looking at it from saying that we're helping adoption for V6 because we're providing that crutch or that backup to prevent V6 from falling on its face. Sorry, don't mean to put words in your mouth, but effectively ensuring that we have network connectivity in a contiguous basis and we use happy eyeballs appropriately to fall back. And Nick's approach of sort of saying like, hey, if you don't get V6 deployed to begin with, right, and take that approach around either a dual stack or a V6 only approach set, you're never going to get there. And I think you're sort of approaching the problems from maybe two different directions, but it's the same end result, maybe.
Yeah, I think even though we're approaching from two different directions, we're kind of meeting in a place that isn't that far apart. So I'd summarize my argument to say, if you're only doing CGN with the express purpose of delaying your IPv6 deployment, I think that's a lot different than what Kevin has described, is using CGN to complement IPv6 so that you can implement happy eyeballs, meet your business needs, while also continuing to make a serious and concentrated investment into IPv6 to deploy it further. And provided you use CGN to do exactly that, then I think it's great. And in that case, it does, in fact, help IPv6 deployment.
And I would agree with that. And I would say that that's a fair summarization of my point, is that when I look at using CGNAT, it's really never I really want IP4 to be around forever. It's just that there are practical problems that become more expensive to solve if you don't deploy it in that fashion. And for a lot of enterprises, that it can be a very cost-effective approach too. Because one of the things I've found is that the more complicated the migration technologies get, you tend to have more expensive equipment to get that done. And so a lot of equipment has supported dual stack for a very long time. So if you have a very simplistic, small CGNAT engine in that you're going to use for a very specific purpose so that you can enable V6, a lot of times it's very, very easy to go in and just turn V6 on natively so that you can get it out there in whatever your environment is. And then, you know, to use Ed's term, to have the crutch, you know, for V4 to kind of to limp along until the day comes that we can turn V4 off. And the only other thing I will say in the enterprise, because we're going through a bit of an identity crisis in the service provider space with V6, in that we rely on MPLS a lot. It is a foundational technology in the service provider space. And we don't really have a clear approach on where that's going to land with MPLS, because we've traditionally used LDP for signaling, which is not really IPv6 is, like, I think a couple of vendors have it, but it's not really taken off because segment routing has really kind of taken off. And if that was just it, that would solve the problem. But we have a bit of an identity crisis in segment routing too, because we have SRMPLS, and then we have SRv6.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of discussion around where that's going to go, and a lot of service providers have hitched their wagons to different things.
We're going to put a pin on that one, because that's a whole show.
That's a whole
it is.
Show,
yeah. And I'll pause it and end it just by saying that in the enterprise, if you have MPLS considerations, then you, secure grade NAT again becomes a helpful technology to consider, because you can run more traditional underlays where you have dual stack V4 and V6 networks to help facilitate that, and then bring in that NAT technology, NAT 44 for your V4 networks if you're doing enterprise data center networking that requires MPLS, because native V6 is a lot harder with multi-tenancy in figuring out which way you want to go.
Yeah, I can't agree more. But we're actually—it's funny enough. Tom and I are working with a customer right now that has exactly this issue. So, yes, it's very real.
How do we turn on IPv6 LDP? Well, you don't.
Yeah, it's pretty funny. Well, gentlemen, fantastic discussion. I can't thank you enough. Yeah, unfortunately, unlike V6, we sort of run out of space for the podcast. But thanks to today's guests, Kevin and Nick, I want to allow you to explain how the audience can follow you on the internet, because you both have just great content and good stuff. And so, talk about, blogs, books, public appearances, if you have them, although that's a little weird, maybe virtual appearances is better, Twitter handles, et cetera. So Nick, why don't we start with you?
Yep. You can, on Twitter, it's Nick Russo 42518. If you can't remember that, my website is njrusmc.net. And the Pluralsight course that we've been talking about, it actually published this morning. Two hours and 50 minutes of pure IPv6 fun. So you can check out this stuff on Pluralsight. Again, njrusmc.net is my main site. It's probably the best place to reach me. And again, Ed, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, of course. Kevin.
Yeah, so spoiler alert, I already started watching Nick's IPv6 course because I subscribed to Pluralsight, and so it dropped today, and I already started watching it before the show so I can learn all of Nick's tricks in the enterprise. But you can find me at StubbyRay51 on Twitter, and you can find me on LinkedIn under the profile that will be in the show notes. And then I also, day job is running a consulting company called IP Architects, which is IPARCHITECHS, and we're just an independent consulting firm. We do data center, enterprise, and service provider, and that's where I spend my day.
Awesome. Thanks so much to both of you. You can reach the IPv6 Buzz podcast on Twitter at IPv6 Buzz. You can also hit up each one of us on Twitter. Tom is at IPv6 Tom. Scott, when Scott's here, is at Scott Hoag, and I'm at E. Horley. Thanks for listening to the IPv6 Buzz. You can find us on the Packet Pushers or any of your favorite podcast apps. Just search for IPv6 Buzz. And if you like the show, please give us a rating on iTunes, Spotify, et cetera, et cetera. And if you like the podcast, we really recommend you check out Heavy Networking, Day 2 Cloud, Network Break Podcast, and all the other great technical content over at packetpushers.net. So long and until next time, we'll see you on the internet. The IPv6 internet, that is.
Thanks for listening to IPv6 Buzz, a podcast devoted to truth, justice, and 128 bits of address space. IPv6.